Shrink Wrap Radio number 323, Aikido, Empathy, and Neurodiversity, with Sensei Nick Walker.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Sensei Nick Walker, and we'll be discussing his psychological reflections on Aikido, as well as his work in neurodiversity and autism. Nick Walker received his MA in somatic psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he now teaches in the undergraduate interdisciplinary studies program. He holds the rank of sixth dan, sixth degree black belt, in Aikido, and has taught the art of Aikido to adults, teens, and children for over 30 years. He's the founder and senior instructor of the Aikido Shusekai Dojo in Berkeley, California. Since 1996, he has been a core member of the experimental physical theater group Paratheatrical Research. Some of his work with Paratheatrical Research is chronicled in director Antero Ali's documentary films, Crux, 1999, Orphans of the Delirium, 2004, and Dream Body / Earth Body, 2012. He's a dedicated autism rights activist and has been deeply involved with the neurodiversity movement for over a decade. He is a teacher, trainer, speaker, and consultant on a wide range of topics, including somatics, embodiment, autism, neurodiversity, conflict transformation, creativity, and transformative learning. Now, here's the interview. Nick Walker, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. I'm glad to have this opportunity to speak with you and to learn about your work. First, let me congratulate you on your recent marriage to the former Asya Zur, now Asya Walker, who's been helping me to assemble my continuing education courses for the Zur Institute.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, I'm happily married now.
Yeah, big step.
Yes.
Now, incredibly, Asya and I have never met in person, but through our online contacts, she comes across as a very wonderful person, and she's frequently spoken of you and also talks enthusiastically about her involvement with Aikido.
She is a wonderful person. Yes, I can vouch for this, and I do get to see her in person. And she is wonderful online. She's even better in person.
Yeah, you've actually kind of staked your life on that.
Oh yes.
And actually,
so far so good.
Yeah, right. And actually, it's as a result of her rave reviews that I've wanted to interview you.
Mm-hmm. She may be biased.
Yeah, it may be. We'll see. So I've been on your Facebook page, and I see that you've been giving some interviews lately on Aikido as a pathway to empathy. And mm-hmm. I've had a longstanding interest in the martial arts myself. And if I were a young guy starting over again, I think Aikido would be my first choice. But before we get into all that, tell us about your background and how you were drawn into the martial arts and Aikido in particular, as well as what drew you into the particular master's program that you graduated from. So let's start with the Aikido part. I'm assuming Aikido came before graduate study. So
much way before. I started Aikido. I started training in Aikido when I was 12.
So oh my goodness,
that was somewhat before my graduate studies.
Yeah, really. When you were 12, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I say, how did that happen that you got started so early?
Oh, how did that happen? Sorry, I'm getting a little interference on the line. I missed the question the first time around. How did I get started so early? Initially, I just had, there's a combination of things. There was a sense of, when I was young, of wanting something more than the values that were presented to me, in school and in my immediate community. So I had an early interest in Eastern spirituality from grade school, just knowing nothing about it except that that it seemed to, it had a reputation for offering something beyond the very materialistic values of the community that was immediately around me. So I had that curiosity going on. And then I just had that, I had the self-defense interest. I grew up in a very violent low-income housing project and then encountered a lot of bullying and violence in school.
Yeah.
And so I made a decision. I made a decision when I was 12 to fight back. And it was a great decision. And so the martial arts, initially there was this idea, oh, learn how to fight more effectively, which is, of course, brings a lot of people to the martial arts. And I didn't know anything about any martial arts, really. I didn't know what differentiated one from the other. But I was 12 years old, and this was a time that Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris were just becoming very popular.
Sure, I remember.
Among young people. And yeah. So I heard a lot about, karate. There were two martial arts available in the town that I was in. There was karate and there was Aikido that had just started, just opened up to people. A couple had moved to town and started teaching Aikido, which, you know, no one in town had ever heard of before, or no one I knew had heard of.
Yeah.
And so I had this choice between karate and Aikido, and I went for Aikido because it wasn't popular with the other kids.
That probably
says something
about
people
you,
who
right?
really were my impression of karate came from the kids who were really into Bruce Lee movies and would, you know, shout "wah!" and kick each other, and it seemed very unappealing to me. So I looked for a martial art that wasn't that, and that's what brought me to Aikido.
Yeah, fascinating. So, and you've had quite a career in Aikido, going all the way to sixth dan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's anything higher than that or not.
There's seventh and eighth, but I can't even imagine what it would feel like to be at those levels. That's a long way off.
Okay. And so tell us about the academic side, because I see that you did go to graduate school. Tell us a bit about your academic career.
I did. I didn't start going to college at all until I was in my early 30s. Going to school, going to elementary school and, you know, schools for troubled and criminal youth, and then back into public high school and all that. None of that was very appealing to me. You know, I had some enjoyable times in high school and made some good, you know, good friends in high school and got to explore my interest in the visual arts more in high school. But overall, you know, my experience of school as a young person was very negative, and I also had the impression I wasn't something that I was good at or that I was cut out for. And even just looking at looking at the college application process and the paperwork involved in it, I had no idea how to approach it or how I would pay for it or anything like that. And so I just stayed out of that for years and years. You know, I was teaching Aikido and working a succession of, you know, various jobs, you know, blue collar jobs or semi-legal jobs, or, you know, sometimes being homeless, and kept practicing and teaching Aikido through all of that. And in my early 30s, I had a big switch where based on my knowledge of kinesthetic learning, you know, learning through the body, I got a job at a tutoring center that worked with special needs students. They were looking for people who were from outside the established system of special education and such, people who were coming in without those preconceptions and could work with the kids who the regular system wasn't working for, work with the kids who needed a more engaged, more physically engaged forms of learning. And so I kind of lucked into this a tutoring job, and sort of things started falling into place there. I was reminded of that I had this longstanding interest in working with teens who had the same sort of troubles and struggles that I had when I was young. There was a sense I just kind of realized, first of all, that I was not going to get to do the things I wanted to do. These interests, I was at a glass ceiling. You know, just being a reading tutor, I was at a glass ceiling where I could never really set policy or influence the discourse on how these things were done,
right?
Unless I got some education, and so I decided to do it. I started going to Berkeley City College, and I discovered, oh my God, I'm actually good at school. It's something that was some transition. I learned to work with my own brain and my own style of learning better. And, you know, of course, college is very different, you know, especially around here in the Bay Area, where you tend to have more enlightened educators. So, you know, my experience of elementary school and high school was just, you know, enforced conformity, preparation for being a cog in the machine. And my experience at college was very different from that. And I was good at it. So I ended up, I got a AA degree from Berkeley City College and was valedictorian of my class. And so could kind of go anywhere I wanted to finish my BA and go on from there. And I went on to a California Institute of Integral Studies because they had the sort of programs I wanted. And I'd been hearing about them for some time from people I'd been working with in Aikido and such. And I kind of thought of it as, oh, this is this really amazing place where they do this fascinating work that unfortunately is out of my reach because I'm not an academic. And so I discovered that nothing academic was out of my reach and that I could navigate that world very well.
So I finished
my BA at CIIS and went into their somatic psychology program. And after finishing that, I started teaching in the undergraduate program, the same undergraduate program there that I had graduated from, the interdisciplinary studies BA program. So I'm teaching in that program, and I'm also finishing a doctorate in transformative studies there. So I'm very immersed in CIIS.
Yeah, good
right
for
now,
you.
Now really loving that school and that community.
Yeah, what an interesting path. Now, most people associate martial arts with aggression. Actually, that's what first drew you in that direction.
I certainly made that association when I first started it.
Yeah, and not particularly with a gentle trait such as empathy.
Right.
So tell us about Aikido as a pathway to developing empathy, which is something you've been talking about recently.
Yes, I have. What I'm doing with Aikido as a teacher and as a practitioner has definitely shifted and evolved over the years, as I've shifted and evolved over the years. It's been a central part of my own path, my development as a human being. And so, of course, as I evolve, my Aikido evolves and what I teach evolves. And I'm really... compassion and empathy are such a central to what I teach in every aspect of my work. Now, Aikido has an intention. The intention is built into the art. The art was founded just in the mid 20th century by a fellow named Morihei Ueshiba. Ueshiba resolved very early in his life to become a great martial artist and became, within the martial arts world of Japan of his day in the first half of the 20th century, became really unbeatable, became the guy, the latest guy nobody could beat, you know, and kind of heir to this tradition of Japanese sword masters and jiu-jitsu masters and a very formidable fighter. And then he had a midlife crisis, as it were. He had a spiritual crisis in his early middle age where he saw on a personal level, you know, that he was starting to age and was thinking, you know, okay, well, I worked really hard to be unbeatable and soon I'll get older and older and other people will come along, you know, the next generation will come along and somebody will beat me. And you know, where does it get us? You know, what is this developing? Why am I teaching this? What is this developing? And there was also, he was a devout Shintoist, a member of a very pacifist Shinto sect. And so the competition and aggression in the martial arts was very much increasingly at odds with his spiritual beliefs. And then he saw what was happening on a larger scale Japan's involvement in World War II, where this martial culture that he had been such a big part of it, such a contributor to and so involved in, was leading on a global scale to atrocities. And so Aikido was really a very intentional. He went into seclusion for a while, went into meditation, seclusion, a deep meditation, and had a deep spiritual revelation. Mm-hmm. And out of that spiritual revelation started developing Aikido, where the intent of the art was as a martial art that was founded on principles of love and compassion, and where the intention was not to compete with other people and defeat other people. As he said, not to fight with and defeat the enemy, but to win over the mind of discord in oneself. And so that's he regarded it as he really created Aikido as a path of love and a path of compassion, a path of spiritual development that would teach people to build compassionate communities, compassionate relationships with each other, and to protect the world and themselves and each other. And there is this built-in paradox of how you do this through a martial art, but it's beautiful. It's beautiful in a Jungian sense, because you're getting at peace and love and compassion, but you're getting at it going through the shadow, not by trying to stay away from conflict, but by really immersing yourself in it and facing and owning where your fear and aggression and competitiveness is.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you really, we're a full contact martial art. You come in right from day one. Of course, we're very gentle and sweet with beginning students. But right from day one, we're working and with practice partners who are grabbing us and pushing us and, there's physical aggressive contact, and we're learning, instead of going off, and doing yoga or meditation, doing this retreat atmosphere where people, try to make the situation as peaceful as possible. Yoga classes are designed to be very peaceful, and everybody kind of stays on their own little mat, or meditation retreats. The atmosphere is very peaceful. In Aikido, you come into the situation where the other people in your practice community are constantly doing things that are designed to trigger all of your issues and difficulties around fear and aggression and competitiveness. People are grabbing you and throwing you on the ground. And so you really get confronted with that, with what comes up. How do I open my heart in this situation? Not how do I open my heart because it feels so safe to open my heart here in this beautiful place where everyone's so nice to me, but we do, of course, create a very safe, sweet, kind environment in my Aikido dojo, but there is this, how do I open my heart, how do I physically relax, open my heart, pay deep attention to my own body and to what's happening with this other person while this person is throwing a punch at me or grabbing me?
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. And from what I know of Aikido, it seems to be very much about trying to go along with the other person's energy so that if they're pushing, instead of you pushing back, you kind of go with the direction of their flow. And also there's a lot of circular movement, which you brought Jung into the conversation here. And the circle is very much an important symbol in Jungian psychology, a symbol of wholeness. So somehow you and this aggressive force become part of a circle.
Yes, exactly, and part of a broader dance. So what happens is, there's a punch coming. There's something very linear and aggressive, a punch, a grab, some sort of aggressive action on the part of someone else, and the idea is, well, how do I dance with it? And bring it into a circular, spiraling motion, bring it into a motion where I can create a motion in my own body and bring my partner into it. Create a motion that encompasses my partner, encompasses kind of encompass them in my sphere of empathy and my sphere of attention so that they get drawn into my circular motion and the force of their attack gets drawn in a direction, you know, that it just redirects it a little bit and, you know, ends with the attacker on the ground. It's beautiful. It struck me as beautiful from the first time I saw it. You know,
it's beautiful.
I want to do this dance. Yeah. There's these beautiful circular and spiraling motions.
Right. It's beautiful to watch. Even the costume is beautiful with the long flowing pants, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe pants or apron. It's really a black pants worn over a white martial arts gi. And very graceful motions. And so I can see how there's empathy at the roots of it, because in a sense, you're having to put yourself in the shoes of the attacker. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, very much. And feel, and at the same time, you know, be grounded in your own shoes or in your own feet, since we're practicing barefoot. But, right. You know, be grounded in your feet. Be grounded in deeply feeling what your own body is doing, so you can keep doing these motions, you know, requires relaxation. And there's this relaxation we cultivate, which is the opposite of how most people's, you know, fight-flight responses. Fight-flight freeze all involve a great deal of physical tension. And we're looking at finding a power that comes from being able to create motions that flow through the entire body. And it requires a deep relaxation of the body and a deep consciousness of the body, so that you're aware of any physical tensions that want to arise and find ways to turn them into movement rather than have them be blockages. And then when your body is relaxed, your heart is open, and you're really keeping building your capacity to feel, and then feeling what your own body is doing, and then feeling what the other person's body is doing, being able to feel, to blend with the person's body and direct their body involves, you have to learn to not fight the other person's body and to direct it in a way so the body is naturally inclined to go. And that requires a compassionate attention, an attention to this other person's body, not as a target, but as a living organic thing that your body as a living organic thing is relating to. And how can we build a relationship between these two bodies that ends ideally with no harm coming to either of us?
Yeah. You know, I was struck by something that I believe originated with you. Somebody else, I think, was quoting you on your Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes as follows. I spent a long time wishing I could find a safe space in this world. Eventually, I realized I was never going to find one, so I set out to create safe spaces. Eventually, after a lot of bad years and hard lessons, I realized that it was impossible for me to find a safe space or to create one. So I set out to become a safe space, and so far, that's worked out pretty well for me.
Yeah, that is a quote from me.
Yeah, I thought that's a good quote.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. A lot of people liked it. Yeah. I posted it on Facebook just spontaneously, you know, in response to some issues that friends of mine were having in different spaces and communities they were in, that just brought up that, you know, it got me thinking about my own relationship to safety, and it's like, oh, this is something I've never tried to articulate before. And I guess it came out well the first time around, which is always nice when that happens.
Yes, it is. Now, you mentioned Shintoism, the founders and coming from a Shinto position.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship of Aikido to Buddhism and meditation? And is meditation part of what you teach in your dojo?
Meditation is certainly part of my own personal practice. And there's a question, of course, of what we mean by meditation, because it can be a very broad word. And as in a way, Aikido is a meditation in rapid movement, sort of like, mm-hmm. you know, the Sufis do this meditation where they spin, they whirl, yes. you know, and that doesn't look like maybe our conventional Western sense of meditation that involves sitting quietly in stillness, you know, mm-hmm. watch the Sufis do these amazing dances where spinning and spinning and spinning, but that is meditative. And so Aikido can be a meditation itself in that sense. We do something in Aikido. There's a practice called Zanshin, as you one finds in various martial arts. And the idea of Zanshin, it means something, continuous attention. And the idea is maybe when you're first learning the art, you're focused on, well, where do I put my foot? You know, how do I move here? And you're getting all these little pieces, but what you're working towards is this continuous attention where there's no breaks. There's no breaks in your attentiveness to your own body and your attentiveness to your partner's body. So the whole practice, the whole time that you're on the mat practicing becomes this continuous dance. It's not just, oh, this person attacks and now I have to pay attention in order to throw them, but rather we're constantly in a state of attention. We're watching people practice, you know, as a student, maybe one is watching the instructor demonstrate a technique with this state of deep meditative attention. And then you're asked to practice the technique in partners and you bow to a partner. There's already this deep attention to who this person is and this deep compassion and sense of how do I make a connection with this other human being. And in between techniques, as you begin to practice together and attack each other and throw each other, whether or not you're in physical contact, you're still maintaining the state of deep attention. And so that is Zanshin, and that becomes a meditation. And Aikido practice is very much works with the same principles as any mindfulness meditation. So Zen meditation has been a big part of my own practice, and I was actually taught how to sit Zazen by an Aikido teacher of mine when I was 21. They've been practicing it ever since. And in Zazen meditation, you do this practice, you know, you're sitting and you're watching your breathing, which sounds simple. And of course, I have a saying as a teacher, if it sounds simple or looks simple, it's probably very difficult. Mm-hmm. Simple and easy are by no means the same thing. They're often opposites. There's a simple practice of focus on the breath, and then, of course, one's mind will drift away from the breath. And so the practice is to gently catch its wandering and gently return your attention to the breathing rather than getting caught up in whatever ego games go on. You know, oh, my attention is wandering again, or oh, I'm doing so well.
Right.
Doing so poorly, right? Instead, just keep gently returning it to the breathing. The same thing happens in Aikido. Gently, you know, get caught up maybe in trying to throw this person, trying to make them fall. It's like, oh, you know, once you've done that, you've lost your own center and your own consciousness of your body, your own consciousness of your heart, and of the other person as a complete human being. They become an obstacle instead of a human being for whom you have an empathic regard. And so then you gently return your attention, gently bring your attention back to your center, back to your heart, and to the dance you're doing. And that process of continuous getting better and better at catching the deviations from being in the flow and gently returning yourself to the flow is to be part of the heart of a meditation practice. And so I do that both in, you know, Zazen meditation practice and in Aikido.
I like what you said about simple and easy being opposites. Yeah, that's quotable right there. You know, For years I studied judo, and judo's become an Olympic sport. Would you ever want to see Aikido in the Olympics?
Absolutely not. No, no. And judo was developed with the intent of it being, you know, a competitive sport. You know, I mean, it's Aikido and judo have a similar roots in that they were developed by people who had found some deep compassion in their own hearts. And, you know, the jiu-jitsu scene in Japan you know, in the 1800s and early 1900s. It was very brutal. People were killed in jiu-jitsu matches and maimed. People, you know, really damaged each other horribly in these brutally competitive matches. And so in judo, of course, you had the way to make this a sport where people could have all of the lessons of this competitive sport of contact with another person, searching for another person's balance and feeling them out, and how to do that without the brutality of breaking people's bones, how to do that in a way that harmonized with the body a little more. And so in that sense, it has the same root as Aikido there. Aikido, but judo again was, how do we make this competitive sport more gentle and more harmonious and less about these brutal oppositions?
Yeah.
How do we get some grace and some compassion into this practice, into this sport? In Aikido, there's that same sense of how do we bring this grace and compassion into it? How do we bring love into this practice? But it's not competitive in its intention. Competition is not part of it. That was deliberate, that the founder of Aikido wanted people's attention off of competition and off of competitive values and onto a concept of being a warrior that was about where the enemy, if there's an enemy, is one's own desire to have enemies, or one's own fear, or one's own brutality, one's own insecurity. And so it's a victory over the self, victory over the weaknesses or unreclaimed shadow or fear-based thinking in oneself. And since it's a spiritual path in that sense, and competition, focus on competition would distract from that. And also Aikido is, at the beginning, in the early years of one's training, and I speak from a lifetime of extensive practice, where when I say the early years of one's training, I mean, you know, the first 20 years of training.
Okay.
But in the early years of one's training, there's certainly a focus, as there is in so many arts, on the technical aspects and building a body of technique and technical skill. But eventually with Aikido, one is really trying to tap into, and I'm speaking in my own practice, because I think that this has been lost in a lot of Aikido schools. For the founder of Aikido, Aikido was an expression of the deep relationship that he was cultivating with spiritual sources, with, you know, as a Shintoist and animist, for him, he was building his spiritual practice, his religious practice, and was about building a relationship to a world of spirit. And Aikido for him was an external expression of something that was springing forth inside him, that was emerging, something he was channeling into the world. His techniques were channels. So he was tapped into something deep in the universe, and something that he thought of as a universal spirit of love and compassion and protection. And he was tapped into that and looking to channel it in his technique and in his practice. And you can see that in, you know, films of him as he gets older and older, you know, and in the last years of his life, he was very, he was in his 80s and had cancer, and he was very feeble often. You know, he was very feeble, and he would have to be, you know, you go to practice and do a demonstration, and have to help him up, get up the stairs. Once he got onto the mat and bowed and sort of invoked into himself these what he felt was the spirit of Aikido, the spirit of Budo, the warrior's way. Once he brought that spirit into himself, suddenly he was moving with enormous power. It's enormous power and grace coming out of this tiny feeble old man. I mean, you know, be throwing these big people across the room. My point in this is that there's, at the root of Aikido, there's a sense of, there's a shamanic practice at the root of Aikido. There's a tapping into some transpersonal source, and the one's art, one's practice becomes an expression of one's connection to this source. And because of that, Aikido at its more advanced levels becomes a deeply personal, spontaneous expression. And I don't see how you could turn that into an Olympic sport, because there's not a way, you can't judge technique, you can't judge form. You can judge someone's form in gymnastics and such. You can judge someone's form in the early stages of their Aikido practice. How well are you doing this technique? You know, are your feet in the right place? Are you successfully protecting yourself, you know, covering yourself so you're not open to being hit here? But at these advanced levels, there's a channeling of some unique personal connection to the transpersonal. And that's not something that can be really rated or judged, I think. That's not something where you can say, this person did it better than this from the outside, I think. I don't know how you could score that.
You know, there's a lot more that we could discuss about Aikido, other questions I'd like to ask and observations I'd like to make, but I'm aware of the time, and I want to move on to some other aspects of what you're doing and to kind of bridge over to the psychological, although much of what you have said is profoundly psychological, and and hopefully listeners will be able to make translations as to why this would be relevant, let's say, for people who are studying psychotherapy or who are psychotherapists themselves.
I'm guessing you have a pretty sophisticated audience.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. So among the many hats that you wear, you describe yourself as a neurodiversity consultant, and I believe you have a particular specialization in autism. Mm-hmm. So how is it that you became a champion for these conditions?
I am autistic myself, and that's where it started.
I'm wondering.
I was acutely aware growing up as a kid who was, you know, in special ed programs some of the time, and then in schools for disturbed and troubled youth and, you know, criminal youth and whatever, different times, and a kid who did not fit into the machinery that the school system is there to help kids fit into or to make kids fit into. And I was in that situation, and I was also in the situation of growing up with a general awareness of diversity issues, because I grew up in a low-income housing project, mostly African-American neighborhood, but I went to school, a lot of affluent white kids, you know, and then, of course, I'm descended from survivors of the Holocaust and of Eastern European anti-Semitic pogroms. And so on multiple levels, multiple areas of my life from very early childhood, I was aware of diversity issues and social injustice and how certain groups were marginalized and the mechanics of that. And I was very attuned to that and very angry as a young person because I was aware of this and couldn't find other people who were seeing what was happening. Mm-hmm. It was a big revelation for me eventually to discover people like Michel Foucault and Bell Hooks and Audre Lorde and people who were articulating this stuff that I had been seeing and had been unable to articulate to other people.
I'm interested in...
I was aware from early on that the treatment of people whose brains work differently from that of the majority, autistic people and other people whose brains work differently from that of the majority, that this was a diversity issue, and that the treatment, oppression of people of what I'd call neuro-minorities in society mirrored the oppression of, say, ethnic minorities or sex and gender minorities.
Interesting. Now, it's hard to believe that you were or are autistic. I mean, you don't come across as an autistic person. So did you outgrow it? What was that diagnosis based on, or was it a diagnosis that was ever officially hung on you?
I am officially diagnosed as autistic. I would say that when people say I don't come across as autistic, I think what they usually mean is I don't fit the popular stereotypes of what the limitations of an autistic person are.
Right.
you know, the world these days is, I mean, I think the world has always been full of autistic people who, in many cases, you know, I mean, autistic people who have confounded stereotypes and expectations. And these days, what, as autism is more widely diagnosed, that becomes more visible. You know, it used to be people would only get some kind of diagnosis if they were very dramatically disabled in particular visible ways. But there's an increased awareness of autism and an increased diagnosis, and people are being recognized, and more people are being recognized as autistic. But I think that it's rare. We live in a society where autistic people are not well accommodated and are disabled because they're so poorly accommodated. Their needs aren't met. Their learning needs aren't met. And their basic environmental needs aren't met. Society, we live in a world that's really not designed for autistic people. And it is a very small minority of autistic people who can not transcend autism. I don't think that happens. But I think a small minority of autistic people, and maybe a growing minority of autistic people, are learning how to transcend the challenges of being autistic in a world that's not autistic friendly.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned learning. I can't think of what the term is for kind of like learning disabled, learning disadvantaged, that kind of thing. Is that always related to autism, or is it a separate set of issues?
As a neurodiversity activist, and you know, I'm a disability rights activist focused on a particular disabled community, which is neurominorities, and that includes autistic people and you know, people with diagnoses like, you know, their ADHD and various intellectual disabilities and such. Mm-hmm. And the disability rights movement, we have a perspective called the social model of disability, which is disability is not some kind of flaw or defect that's intrinsic to a person. People have differences. They have particular things that they're good at, not good at, particular attributes. And disability comes from an intersection, a complex intersection between what a person's capacities are and what the demands of the situation are, what the demands of the environment are. What skills are valued, how people are taught. So learning disability doesn't mean to me that a person is bad at learning. They're disabled in the sense that their learning abilities are different from what the society and the school system and such think, you know, how society and the school system think people should learn. They don't fit into the society's boxes properly. And so the disability is that intersection. Mm-hmm. It's complex. It's that intersection. They're disabled within a particular context. And disability always occurs within a context. So ADHD is epidemic these days. ADHD is very widespread and a big issue in the school system, where kids are being medicated, and, you know, there's very widely. But ADHD is a product of the modern education system and the modern industrial and post-industrial corporate system, mm-hmm. and people being expected to spend their lives sitting still in little boxes. And the people with this brain, the style of cognition that is currently called ADHD, have always been around, I think, you know, but in a hunter-gatherer society, they're not called ADHD. They're called good hunters.
Yeah, right. I'm wondering if, in some sense, Aikido tapped into your area of strength.
Maybe you
were a particularly kinesthetic learner, and I'm wondering if Aikido, in some sense, saved you or gave you a place to fit into this society.
I've certainly found both. Aikido has helped me to get by in the world and do well in the world as an autistic person, starting very early on with just helping me defend myself, defend my right to be autistic. You know, autistic people are frequently targeted, you know, frequently targeted by bullies and, you know, murdered and abused pretty widely. And so having martial arts skills fairly early in my life was a big help there, just protecting myself. And of course, it's continued. You know, Aikido trains one to confidently be grounded confidently in one's own body and make these confident empathic connections with other people. And that's been very important for me. Well, I mean, the biggest problem that autistic people face in the world when they try, you know, we try to go out in the world and make careers for ourselves and establish relationships, what we run into is, well, we're different from the majority. We think differently and we move differently and our needs are different. Our emotional scales are different. We have different, you know, I mean, there's a challenge in communicating emotionally because I have a different range of emotions from non-autistic people and different sensory experience. So our experiences are vastly different. It's like a cultural difference, you know, multiplied exponentially. And just in terms of the impression we make on people can be very weird. The impression autistic people make on non-autistic people can be very strange because our body language means something different. If somebody's not making eye contact with you, that has particular meanings in mainstream Western society, for instance. For autistic people, it means something different. What eye contact means or doesn't mean is very different for autistic people just because of how we process sensory information. And we move in ways that seem very strange to people, you know, rocking back and forth and stuff. And I mean, this is an audio interview, you know, and if your impression of how autistic or non-autistic I am might be very different if you saw my body language.
Oh, really?
But one thing that Aikido has done for me is let me be weird with confidence. Mm-hmm. And which is really the confidence is crucial, you know?
Yes.
The confidence is autistic people, I think, and people with other, you know, people who are disabled in various ways, you know, especially neurologically, people who are disabled by having neurologies that are very different from that of those of the majority. People like me, you know, our confidence is under attack from very early on. By parents, by teachers, by peers. And so what I see when I look at many autistic people, what I see is that as adults, even as children and as adults, often they're impaired, you know, partly by autism and by having this minority neurological style and these needs that are not well accommodated in society, but also impaired by a lack of confidence that's been imposed on them. And so I am confident. Aikido has helped me become confident in advocating for myself. What started out as a physical confidence in, you know, just I'm going to defend myself. You know, these bullies are going to try to beat up the weird kid, but I'm going to defend myself. Turned into eventually, how do I advocate for myself? How do I say this is what I need in this situation and say it confidently rather than apologizing for myself? I'm autistic. I'm going to need this. You know, if I'm going to work in this situation, I'm going to need this. This is the accommodation I need in this situation. Or even just the presentation of body language comes across very differently. You know, I have some classically autistic body language. I don't do a lot of eye contact. I rock back and forth. I use my hands in unusual ways. But I do it in a way that presents with a great deal of physical confidence and social confidence. And that's the unusual thing, I think, for autistic people, is they've been trained not to be confident in it and to be a little ashamed of it. And because I present it confidently, that makes a very different impression, you know. And I found that, I mean, I've talked to a lot of autistic people. You know, for a lot of autistic people, they're worried about their love life. They're very lonely, you know. They say, you know, well, I can't find a partner because I'm so weird. I'm so different. Nobody understands me. I can't find a partner in life. And that has not been a problem for me in life. I've been married before. I have a daughter from a previous marriage. I've, you know, had a lot of girlfriends, and now I'm married to the most beautiful, wonderful woman in the entire world. And what that's about, really, you know, And that's unusual, I think, for a lot of autistic people, but that's a confidence issue because most people, you know, if you ask your average person, you know, what are you looking for in a partner? What do you hope for? What's your ideal partner? They're not going to say, well, I'd love to have someone who's a complete conformist. I'd love to have someone who's really, really average. Nobody's looking for that, you know? Right. So I think eccentricity doesn't have to be socially crippling if it's carried out in a way that is warm and confident.
Well, this is really a great statement. And unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up. But you've really gotten into some juicy material here towards the end. And it's just wonderful to hear your story and about your journey. And we sort of end up where we started, which was your marriage to a beautiful woman.
Yes, yeah. Very lucky.
Yeah.
And I'd be happy to talk to you again sometime, and maybe we could go more in depth into the topic of autism, you know, because yes. I know it brings up a lot of questions. You probably get a lot of responses to this interview with questions, which I'd be happy to answer in some future interview, because it is a big topic these days.
Yeah. Well, Nick Walker, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I certainly hope you found my conversation with Sensei Nick Walker engaging. What an amazing journey he's been on. His story is a good reminder to us all to be more mindful of our attitudes toward and how we treat those who are different from us. It's wonderful that he discovered Aikido as a path to gaining self-confidence in creating a place for himself in the world. And now to see him marching on to a second degree in higher education, soon to culminate in a doctoral degree. Way to go, Nick Walker. Times when I've watched Aikido practice sessions, workouts, and demonstrations, they've always been relatively slow and flowing. You can find lots of clips about Aikido on YouTube. I would have liked to ask Nick about his impressions about the movie actor Steven Seagal. Maybe you've seen some of his action movies without realizing that the martial art that he is employing is in fact Aikido. My own opinion is that he's demonstrating in his films Aikido at combat speed as opposed to practice speed. It comes across as really fast and really effective. However, I'm not sure about the degree to which Steven Seagal embodies or does not embody the spiritual dimension of Aikido. I seem to recall that you can find clips of him on YouTube demonstrating Aikido as well. There are some past Shrink Wrap Radio episodes which would make good companion pieces for this episode if you haven't heard them or would like to review them. I'm thinking of number 267, The Horse Boy, with Rupert Isaacson, telling the story of his family's journey across Mongolia by horseback in search of a shaman who could heal his son's autism. Also number 246, Exploring Savant Syndrome with Daryl Treffert, MD, with Savant Syndrome being one variant of autism. And of course, number 268, Visual Thinking in Autism with Temple Grandin, PhD. Each of these bears on the subject of autism and underscores the value of different ways of perceiving the world, just as Nick Walker suggests.
Did you know that Shrink Wrap Radio is now 7 years old? Did you know that between Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel Podcast, that Dr. Dave has conducted over 400 interviews? Did you know that for your convenience, most interviews also have a transcript available? But wait, there's more. If you'd like to listen to the show on the move, now there's an app for that. All the details and purchase links for the Shrink Wrap Radio app are posted on the website.
Thanks for that promo, Mike West. And while we're on the topic of supporting the show, somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 people are listening to each episode. Compare that to the fact that somewhere between 20 and 30 people make a regular contribution to support the show. I'm constantly being urged by marketing types to stop giving away so much content for free. However, I'm so reluctant to change the model. So won't you please help me to continue things as they have been by clicking on the big green donate button on our site to make a one-time or ongoing donation towards the support of Shrink Wrap Radio. As many of you may realize, I've been encouraging you to share your email address with me on Shrink Wrap Radio by offering access to a dream lecture I gave some time back, and we also have a survey on the Shrink Wrap Radio site that, among other things, asks for your email address. Well, all of this was against the day that I might finally get around to creating a periodic newsletter. Well, somehow, I have never quite found the energy to get that project off the ground. However, thanks to the strategic alliance that I formed with the Jung Platform, we'll be putting out a joint newsletter. I expect that we'll put it out on a monthly basis, and we're hoping that won't be overwhelming for you. So I think you can expect to see our first offering in that regard in your email box quite soon. Keep your eye out for it. You'll recall that this alliance is both with the Jung Platform and also the Depth Psychology Alliance. They are offering a November special to you sponsored by the Joseph Campbell Foundation, which will be a live video event on November 1st titled Mythology, Health, and Healing, and it's delivered by Bob Walter. If you'll click on the 25% off link in the right-hand sidebar, it will take you to the partners page on our site that will give you full details about that event. Just look for the flyer at the bottom of the partners page. With your discount, this video event will cost only $11.99, and I believe you'll have access to it even if you aren't available to watch it in real time. Please help support our partners, and in the process, you'll also be supporting Shrink Wrap Radio. As I've mentioned previously, I know many, if not most of you, are listening to these interviews on a mobile device, but I really want to encourage you from time to time to actually go to our website at shrinkwrapradio.com to check out some of the special offers that won't show up on your mobile device. Maybe there's a way to make them show up there. If you know how to do that, let me know. Another example of that is the link in the right-hand sidebar that will help you to actually make money filling out surveys with one of my marketing research partners. If you're a new listener, you might not be aware that we also have an extensive list of continuing education courses on our site. You can earn CE units just for listening to Shrink Wrap Radio interviews and answering some true-false questions about what you've heard. You'll find these by clicking on the Store tab at the top of our site. For example, right now I'm working on our fifth Jung course, which I hope to release before long. Most of you will be aware that I conducted a two-day weekend workshop in Stockholm last month. Well, I'd love to conduct one in your area, and I've put a link in the right-hand sidebar that reads, Weekend Dream Workshop in Your Area. Click on that, and it will take you to the proposition, along with a short video endorsement from Simon Jansson from the Stockholm Workshop. And Simon, thanks for that, and I hope you'll forgive the butchering of your last name. Finally, I've been dragging my feet a bit on finalizing this episode in hopes of a last-minute transcript to announce. Alas, no last-minute transcript. So those of you who've promised transcripts, and you know who you are, please get them to me. And thanks.
Shrink Wrap Radio, the podcast that's always on your mind, here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, my good friend Oscar. Psychotherapy graduate student, longtime listener and participant and co-organizer of my dream workshop in Stockholm. Now, on to a recent email from our listener community. This one reads, "Dear Dr. Dave, my name is Carly, and I'm a high school English teacher. Being a teacher, I feel my role is both pastoral as well as academic, and thus incorporate some psychological strategies into my practice. For instance, I assist my munchkins and monsters with their stress management, study skills, and writing techniques using excellent psychology strategies. I have experienced clinical depression and feel that mental illness is an important area to focus on and combat using skills in order to lead a meaningful and healthy life. Your podcasts reiterate what I read as well as reflect my therapy sessions. I drive an hour each way to work and greatly appreciate your podcasts as they make the challenging journey stimulating and productive. I often get ideas for my creative writing workshops. The mindfulness techniques to enhance creativity worked particularly in the classroom, as well as did the sensory exercise where my students began to notice things they had never picked up on before. Thank you again for providing a free and valuable service to the world. I greatly appreciate your work and thoroughly enjoy your in-depth and interesting discussions. Warm regards," and that's from Carly. Well, Carly, thank you. I so appreciate your taking time to write, and I'm very glad to hear that you're making such good use of my shrink wrap radio interviews. I'm especially happy to hear that they support both your personal work in psychotherapy as well as in your teaching. And so with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on our site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. And you can leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Sensei Nick Walker, for sharing his passion regarding both Aikido and neurodiversity. My next guest will be Dr. Roland McCready, Director of Research at the Institute of Heart Math, whose mission is to facilitate a fundamental shift in health, well-being, and consciousness. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shrink Wrap Radio, all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.